Okay, thank you very much. Our first speaker is John Blundell. I'm going to keep the introductions fairly brief for the day, just so you know, because you all have you should have the bios somewhere in your program. John, who I just met yesterday, has published widely on the field of biological and psychological mechanisms of appetite control, energy balance, and regulation. He's published over 350 papers, and his article on serotonin and satiety is a citation classic. He is a research chair of psychobiology at the University of Leeds in the UK. And also, I should say, he had to rearrange his schedule in order to come here, so we're very appreciative of his presence.
I should say it wasn't such a great sacrifice to rearrange my schedule. Thanks very much for inviting me to come. Thanks, Lorette, Anna, and Nicolina. And thank you for giving me such a graphic title to speak to. It may not be an auspicious start because I'm not going to speak directly about the brain. And I find much of my talks now are conceptual. But since I've only got 25 minutes, can I check that I'm starting 10 minutes late? I've only got 25 minutes, so it's going to be a bit of a dash through these procedures. And as I speak, I find myself more and more describing to myself why I'm doing what I'm doing. And so you're welcome to listen on this conversation I'm having with myself. Talking about the phenotype, and clearly a phenotype implies that there is a genotype, I don't want to dismiss the idea of genes, but my main focus today is on the phenotype, because I'm interested in why people express as actors the behaviors they do in this environment and what are the consequences of that. I'm going to break with tradition and put my conclusions first in this form. What do I think I know? I'm not certain that I do know very much, but what do I think I know? First of all, there are multiple susceptible phenotypes, which means there are many routes to obesity. And these would be composite phenotypes, the combinations of homeostatic and hedonic elements, which makes management of obesity very difficult. The individual biological variability that we would deal with is huge and much greater than we often care to admit. From my perspective, an energy balance framework to obesity is essential because intake and expenditure together contribute to storage of energy. Weight gain leads to a weakening of the regulatory signal, which means it's, in a sense, reverse homeostasis. As people get fat, the amount of fat that they accumulate in their body doesn't help them to control their appetite. In fact, it makes it worse. So there's a positive feedback rather than negative feedback. Physical activity, however, improves this regulatory capacity. And in the area of hedonics, I would make a case for implicit wanting as a promising marker. And because it is a brief process, it reflects a brain process. And I think there can be a useful way in which implicit wanting can be used to throw light on the brain. And finally, a multi-level interdisciplinary platform is useful. Well, I show here a few papers. Just in case there is anybody in the audience who hasn't not read all of my papers, here are a few of them. I know it's a remote possibility. I show these because for most of my career I have been a systems theorist, and so when I heard about the Brain to Society plan with its various systems approach, I was immediately taken by it. And this is one of the pictures that you can find in the published output of the Brain to Society plan. It has at its center the brain. I've been involved in similar planning and systems in the UK as part of the Department of Science and Innovation Foresight team, and we developed a similar map of the sum total of influences on obesity in these various domains. It's a little bit different because at the center of this map is not the brain, but energy balance. And this is the way in which I focus my interest in this area. Energy balance, because energy intake and energy expenditure are both linked together in habitual routines which prevent people from breaking into the cycles of activity which keep them at a particular weight. Now, energy balancing implies energy intake and energy expenditure, and it's still hotly debated which of these is responsible for obesity. I put this slide here to show three points. One is that when we speak about energy expenditure, there are 20 to 40% of that is behavior. When we think of energy intake, 100% of that is behavior. Energy intake is eating behavior, which means that behavior plays a huge role in energy balance, quite apart from physiology. And instead of Cartman in the middle, there is a regulatory system. So the relationship between energy intake and expenditure plays its part as a function of a regulatory principle. These are not just two elements whose tariff can be added up summatively. The one affects the other and vice versa. So defining the issue, what is the issue? I don't think it's a closely guarded secret. In any society, some individuals gain fat and others remain lean. And these can be called susceptible and resistant phenotypes. Now, I think this typology is a relevant level analysis between what we can call the ideographic, the truly individual, and the nomothetic, which is common to the population. And science normally deals with the nomothetic, seeks out causes which are universal. Clinicians, on the other hand, work with individuals. I think the phenotype can offer a level of analysis which is midway between the ideographic and the nomothetic. And investigation of these phenotypes helps us to understand some of the causes. And I keep emphasizing to myself, anyway, that there are many susceptible phenotypes and many routes to obesity. I've been heavily influenced by this study, and one of the authors of it, Louis Peruzzi, is in the audience. As you can see, it was work published over 20 years ago in this province, Quebec feeding study, twin study, and what we see here are the changes in the body weight of twins, pairs, twin A and twin B, after they were subjected to deliberate overfeeding for 6 months. There was a change in weight, and what people remember from this slide is the relationship between twin A and twin B, a very high relationship between the amount of weight gained by one twin and the other twin pair. But what I think is the most interesting feature of these data is not the intra-pair correlation, but the enormous disparity between the different pairs of twins. Some gain 12 kilograms and some only gain 4 kilograms, despite this deliberate overfeeding. And it's this biological variation between the individuals, which in my view is more important than the genetic link between them. And the same is true for the reverse phenomenon when the twins are subjected to deliberate physical activity and energy expenditure. The amount of weight lost by twin A and twin B was very highly correlated, but there's a huge discrepancy between the different twins. So in my view, this variable susceptibility is not in doubt. The question is, how do you define it? Through genetics, physiological profile, regional specific brain activity, metabolic flexibility, and so on. A concept that I like very much was first developed by Eric Raverson, and it shows what happens to individuals who are genetically variable and have variable predispositions, going from resistant to prone or susceptible, in two different sorts of environments. One, a restrictive environment such as you'd find in sub-Saharan Africa, where there is very little expression of the differences along this axis. When you have an obesogenic environment, which is a very powerful concept in my view, when you have an obesogenic environment, it allows these individual differences to be expressed very clearly. And my view is that this allelic variation is present throughout the whole of the population and distinguishes between some people who are very susceptible to gain weight and others who are resistant to gaining weight. There's another feature here which I can mention, which is my view of the elephant in the room, and it is that when we think of populations like this in an obesogenic environment, the main feature, in my view, that leads to the epidemic of obesity in these environments is the socioeconomic system in which we live. And the materialistic philosophy of self-interest that governs much of what people do. That is, the requirement to consume material goods well in excess of any need that they have. All goods, shoes, jackets, furniture, and food. It only happens to be food that makes you fat. We consume everything much more than we need. And not only do we do that, but the socio-economic system supports it, and the cultural values support consumption of food. It's called market growth, industrial growth. Growth can only occur if people consume, and they have to consume in order to stimulate growth. So for me, So for me, the elephant in the room is the socio-economic system, and we don't talk about it because we can't do anything about it. So we have to work within that. So I'm not particularly concerned. I'm worried about it, naturally, but as a researcher, I can't attend to that. I'm concerned about the individual variability. Gosh, that's good. Rather than the managing the epidemic. One interesting interpretation that I put onto this is that susceptibility is obvious, and we do know that the greatest risk factor for obesity is having obese parents. And I believe that when the genome-wide scans were first carried out, there would be a way to identify the actual genes that contributed to this parental risk. But as people are well aware, and I think there'll be more about that this afternoon, when people have found the most common variants that are associated with measures of obesity, and put them together, they collectively explain only about 1% of the variance in BMI, and each additional risk allele adds only a very small amount. Bruce Loos has put it this way, rather nicely. If you arrange these at-risk alleles along the axis here, you can find a gradation between those individuals who possess all of the active at-risk alleles and those who possess none. And there is a difference in BMI, it's not very much, and the difference in waist circumference, again, it's not very much. But in the middle here, there are people with varying numbers of these at-risk alleles, all with the same degree of risk and all with the same degree of improvement in BMI. The issue is that there are different patterns of alleles all producing the same effect. It is not the same pattern of allelic variation that contributes in each of these cases. And so my interpretation of this is that it is this collection of at-risk alleles which generates varying degrees of susceptibility. And susceptibility reflects many allelic variations. So the next question that I refer to, and harking back to my title, is whether or not these allelic patterns can reflect homeostatic and hedonic processes. What's homeostasis in hedonics? Well, most people know this. It's sort of ABC. For homeostasis, we have energy needs providing tonic signals and satiety signaling, which are episodic. In hedonics, which is commonly regarded as conscious pleasure, it's actually much more than that. It does indeed involve liking and reward, wanting or incentive salience, the instrumental features of reward to increase the frequency of behavior, preference and choice, and many conditions that we come across, such as craving, binge eating, compulsive eating, really reflect combinations of homeostatic and hedonic features. Now, most people depict the homeostatic system something like this, in which there are signals coming from adipose tissue to the brain and signals from the GI tract, and hedonics is relegated to a piece of cake up here, which possibly reflects at least the interest that these researchers had in that, or the knowledge that we have about the hedonic system. However, there is a central nervous system instantiation of the homeostatic and the hedonic, and this is a very simple depiction of that. And it's normally understood that it is activity in these circuits here that forms the basis for the conscious sensations of hunger that reflect a need state or a demand state in the body. And these expressions of hunger are, of course, expressed by other parts of the brain. And when we look at the hedonic system, which involves the mesolimbic system, the caudate and the striatum and so on, and opioids and dopamine, it's normally inferred that the encoding of pleasure is carried out by this circuitry here. So homeostatic and hedonic are separate. They do talk to each other quite a lot, but they do encode different features of susceptibility. That's not somebody calling me, by the way. That is my own alarm to tell me how far behind I am in my talk. So I'm going to crack on. So when we want to measure homeostatic and hedonic markers, we need methodology. A homeostatic toolbox, which will capture tonic and episodic processes, rapidly oscillating states, hunger and fullness, accurate eating behavior assay, and data capture through electronic devices, and also enduring traits, such as TFEQ disinhibition, binge eating, and craving. When we come to the hedonic system, Kent Berridge has insisted for a long time that we distinguish between liking and wanting. And there is indeed a coding system in the nucleus accumbens to distinguish between these two at the neural level. So we need a hedonic toolbox in which we operate with three principles. First of all, dissociation of liking and wanting, the distinction between explicit and implicit processes, and to map these processes onto actual food choice. The implicit processes are essential because many people eat for reasons that they can't explain to themselves. Many people have the sensation of needing food or wanting food without knowing exactly why they want it. So something that operates below the level of consciousness is really essential. So I'm back to my title. Susceptible and resistant phenotypes, or thrifty and profligate types, and we've been interested in various phenotypes for quite a long period of time, initially to try and describe the profligate phenotype, whether there are people indeed who can eat whatever they want and not gain weight, and I don't think that is a very viable phenomenon, as a matter of fact. But the Leeds approach to diagnosing susceptibility, which is not a unitary phenomenon, has been going now for about 20 years. I'm going to describe very, very briefly three phenotypes. One, people susceptible to weight gain on a high-fat diet. Secondly, people resistant to weight loss, that is, susceptible to maintaining weight on a physical activity regime when they should lose weight, and a binge eating disposition. Starting point for the first phenotype was susceptibility to a high-fat diet, and my hypothesis that dietary fat was a major risk factor for weight gain and obesity. So I made the prediction that if we could find people who habitually ate a high-fat diet, more than 45% fat, for men more than 110 grams a day, they would be obese. And I was, not for the first time in my career, spectacularly wrong, because when you find people who consume that potential weight-inducing diet, some are fat and some are lean. And this is a distribution from people taken from a national database. And some of these high-fat consumers, and they're all consuming more than 45% fat, some are lean and some are obese. And what happens when you compare these two groups? Well, first of all, you have to control for one very important variable, and that is age, because there is a 10-year difference in the average age of these and these. So it may take 10 years for people to work their way across this spectrum. So when you compare people here and here, you have to make sure they are of the same age to ensure that they've been exposed to the habitual diet for the same period of time. Again, to cut out all the middle ground of the data and so on, the susceptible phenotypes score high on disinhibition and hunger traits on the TFEQ. That is what we call opportunistic eating. They eat more when offered high-fat foods, and they show strong passive overconsumption. When offered high-energy density foods, they overeat on those. They prefer high-fat foods and choose more in a state of satiety. And these high-fat foods exert a weaker suppression of post-meal hunger. So all these characteristics leave this susceptible phenotype vulnerable to overconsumption on high-fat foods. They also show strong hedonic attractions to food and much lower leisure time physical activity. So this is a broad spectrum, complex phenotype. It's not a phenotype defined by one single attribute. It's a phenotype defined by a whole cluster of defects, we might call them, in the control of appetite. And that makes management of a complex phenotype like this very difficult. Now, because of what I've said about the spread of alleles across a population, and even more so the distribution of alleles across different geographical regions, it's important to us to use a single cohort multi-level approach to examine these interrelationships in the same individuals. Because if we take different groups of individuals at different periods of time, we can't be sure they are showing the same allelic variation. And so our research platform now involves simultaneous measurement in parallel processes and includes a time factor. And this is our methodological platform in which we measure features in the environment, in behavior, in psychology, physiology, and in metabolism. So all of the subjects are measured in each of these domains. And back to the energy balance concept again, to go on to the second phenotype, that is the phenotype that is resistant to weight loss on an energy expenditure regime. So looking at the effect of physical activity on energy intake, and we measure motivational processes, appetite response, substrate oxidation, gut hormones, and we recognize that we're dealing with an adaptive regulating system. Now, our inspiration for doing this goes back more than 50 years to the work of Jean Mayer, who was one of the first to investigate the relationship between energy intake and energy expenditure, and he did it in a very difficult environment. That is the jute mills of Bengal in Calcutta. And he measured the energy expended by people whose work varied in intensity in the jute mills. The very heavy laborers here would expend more energy, and the more lighter tasks less, and the sedentary tasks less still. And what he was able to show was that there's a relationship between the energy intake and the energy expenditure. But it only exists for this portion of the relationship. One interesting observation he made was that when you come into this portion of the energy expenditure distribution and find sedentariness, the relationship breaks down. And although he didn't say it, I'll say it, that food intake then is at the mercy of all the contingent variables in the environment. In other words, it is unregulated anymore by energy expenditure and uninfluenced by physical activity, because this curve here should proceed in this direction, but in fact it doesn't. So this is a very interesting phenomenon. In our platform, we've subjected, or we commonly subject, obese subjects to a 12-week regime. 5 days of every week, they receive a one-hour session of physical activity at about 70% VO2 max, which expends about 2 megajoules, or about 500 calories. They all get the same. Every single joule expended is measured. So we know they are doing the exercise. And at the end of that 12-week period, the average weight loss is here. It's about 4 kilos. But again, the average really doesn't tell us anything about what is going on. In fact, it might be the least important parameter. What is important is the distribution of the individuals. Some down here are losing much more than the average, and some are actually gaining weight. They're gaining weight even though we know they have done this exercise. We've measured every joule of it. So some people are responding by actually gaining weight. So this is the resistant phenotype, the phenotype that is resistant to weight loss. And our initial hypothesis was that this type of person would be similar to the person who is susceptible to weight gain on a high-fat diet. Well, again, cutting a long story very short, what are the characteristics of these resistors? They have an increased level of hunger in response to physical activity, increased energy intake, that is, they eat more. They have a decreased fat preference and intake and a reduced passive overconsumption. They have an increased satiety quotient, which means their sensitivity to satiety signaling is upgraded. And there's general upregulation of the energy balance network, strong interaction between energy expenditure and energy intake. Now, this is a very interesting cluster of features, and it's much different from the cluster of features that define the other susceptible phenotype. So these people are definitely not the same. They're a different phenotype with different characteristics. And in fact, they're not really at a disadvantage, even though they don't lose weight. They gain weight, because the weight gain is in fat-free mass. They actually lose fat tissue. I've just received an electric shock through my device, which I think means I should wind down. They also, and I am doing. They show a decreased waist circumference, increased cardiovascular fitness, decreased blood pressure, decreased heart rate, and a range of health markers. They're more healthy people. So although we set out thinking that they were going to be in some way disadvantaged, this particular phenotype, which does not lose weight in response to physical activity as it should, is in fact favored. And so we would make this comment about the Jean Mayer figure. Up here we have a regulated zone in which energy expenditure is related to energy intake. Down here is a non-regulated zone where this relationship does not apply. I would submit that about 80% of the population are in this non-regulated zone. So their appetites are at the mercy of the environment. And if you increase physical activity, it improves satiety signaling and moves people from this area to this area, where they do regulate. They may not lose weight, but they regulate better. And whereas sedentariness undermines the regulatory capacity of the system, physical activity actually strengthens it. Now, in the remaining minute, I'll just move on to the hedonic concepts of liking and wanting, which I mentioned earlier were critical to our understanding of the hedonic process. And we have a particular platform in which we're able to measure liking through pictorial images and wanting through a non-verbal forced choice procedure. And this wanting procedure has an implicit component, which means that we can measure wanting that goes on below the conscious process. And this is the platform that we use with foods in various high-fat, low-fat categories, savory and sweet, and these are presented in turn. And we've examined another phenotype, the binge eating phenotype, which would regard as having a potential for overconsumption. In this particular phenotype, and the colors here indicate the high binge potential and the low binge potential, high and low risk for explicit liking, these people with the at-risk characteristic show an increased liking for all foods. They like everything. But when we look at implicit wanting, which is a subconscious process, they show implicit wanting only for sweet high-fat foods. So there's a clear dissociation between liking and wanting. Greater explicit liking, but only implicit wanting for the high-fat foods. And this implicit wanting is mapped onto actual food intake of sweet high-fat foods. So the implicit wanting is, in fact, validated by its relationship to behavior. And this is my pre-penultimate slide. The variable subgroups, particularly this binge eating risk, high risk of overconsumption, shows an increased generalized liking and also defect in satiety. There's a combination of homeostatic and hedonic features. So I'm back to my conclusions, and I think I've got back to the place where I started. My feeling is that we are dealing with multiple susceptible phenotypes. There are many routes to obesity. These phenotypes are composite, combinations of homeostatic and hedonic elements, which again make management very difficult. There's tremendous individual variability, which we should not underestimate, and we cannot rely on the fact that a group of obese individuals that are studied in this particular area will have the same allelic variation and therefore the same tendency as a group of obese studied elsewhere. The energy balance framework, I still think, is essential. Weight gain leads to a weakening regulatory control, and physical activity improves the regulatory control. Implicit wanting, though I didn't spend much time on it, is a very promising marker and a good construct for a link between food and drug addiction. And the multi-level platform is useful. Thank you very much.
Are there any questions? If you have questions, either use the microphones or speak very loud.
John, lovely talk. Thank you very much. I was going to ask you about those weight loss data, the exercise thing. It's a lovely and very interesting relationship you showed. But you, what is on the x-axis? You have weight loss on one, and on the y-axis, but very or gain. But very, it isn't clear. Is that simply rank order?
It's an array of individuals ranked according to change in body composition.
So if you look at the relationship between weight loss and any other initial parameter, does anything leap out in that study?
Yes, there are certain factors that do, and we've been interested in that because they would constitute either moderators or mediators. So we are particularly interested in what correlates with that spectrum of weight loss. And there are certain psychometric factors like disinhibition that predicts weight loss. And there are also certain physiological factors, including metabolic flexibility. Indeed, the RQ predicts the degree of appetite response and the degree of weight loss. So the other variables that form predictors of weight loss can be either in the psychometric, psychological domain or in the physiological domain.
Like ADHD or OCD tendencies?
You could make that inference that the... You could make that inference. It's not one that's occurred to me.
How did you measure in that study per subject total sleep time over a day?
Total sleep time?
Yeah.
The simple answer to that, we didn't measure total sleep time. That might well just answer your question.
To hear your thought to see to what extent in moving, because us, what we have been moving for is to move from phenotype to endophenotypes to qualify even more in terms of variability in reward seeking, restraint, and so on. Mm-hmm. And in the consumer literature, one of the things that we start seeing is that some intervention, for instance, control portion size, will have a reverse effects for a perverse effects for restraint vs non-restraint individuals. So this notion of moving toward a finer psychological and neurobiological differentiation of those phenotypes, what do you think in moving in this direction?
Well, our approach at the moment is to define the behavioral expression of the phenotype, and to move from the behavioral expression to the physiological and the neural attributes of that. What you mentioned about portion size is interesting because we see that as being one of the features of susceptibility, that the susceptible individual will be more prone to respond to large portions than small portions. And this, in fact, is being tested at the moment in an NIH project in Minnesota. Does that answer the question? Inadequately, I'm afraid.
Dana?
Observed any gender differences in the weight resistance and weight loss
resistance phenotype? Yeah, thank you, Dana. The question, if you didn't hear it, was whether there are gender differences in the weight resistant phenotype, because over the years there's been a view that women are much more resistant to weight loss with exercise than men. In fact, we did not find that. And our view is that when exercise is imposed and supervised, there is no gender difference, and that the gender differences that have emerged in the past are due to compliance, variable compliance. In our platform, we remove compliance completely from the equation.
Does an individual's knowledge of his or her own phenotype modify the responses?
It's a good question. I'm not aware that people are really themselves conscious of their own phenotype. In fact, we can't be conscious of it until we've actually measured them and put them through our platform. But I think it's an interesting idea, the fact that people may feel themselves to be vulnerable to the environment. They may feel that they do have a weakness. That's not something we've explored, but I think it's a very nice idea. And it may, in fact, resonate with the idea that some people like to consider themselves as addicted to food. They actually prefer the epithet, although personally I think it's going to be rather confusing if we adopt it widely. But I found people who do make that attribute about themselves. They feel they are addicted. So that might be part of a phenotype that would be reinforced by the person's own expectations of themselves.
John, very exciting. Did you observe any association by families with diets?
Sorry?
In families.
Well, the answer is no. Although we've looked for it, we haven't been very successful in controlling the dispersion of individuals and getting compliance among all family members. So my answer is very disappointing. Sorry about that.
I have a question. So when an animal loses weight, they defend their body weight. There's a concept of the set point. And so your individuals who exercise, their weight goes down, but presumably if you did nothing to them, their weight would creep back to that set point at some point. Can you change the body weight set point downwards permanently through exercise, do you think?
I don't know that. Our view is that you have to keep doing the exercise to keep at the weight that it brings you to. But I would point out that not everybody loses weight. I mean, one of the features of this research is that great biological variability in the response of the system to an imposed demand of energy expenditure. And for some people, that demand is amplified even and calculated for what it is. In other people, the body resists and adapts to that demand and compensates and even overcompensates. So my view is that when we do studies on any particular individual who is obese, we can't assume that that person is typical of every obese person on the planet, because there's a fantastic range of variability within the obese, just as there is within leans.
Can I just make a comment on your question about whether or not body weight can be set point can be set down? I think there's data coming out of Colombia from Rita Lavelle's approach that shows that although you can actually set points upwards, I think getting a set point down, an evolutionary perspective, is not possible. I think he has some data showing that downwards of a set point is not possible.
Yeah. That's the trend.
Well, I have another response, but unfortunately, until the paper is finally accepted for publication, I'm a bit worried about revealing what it is. So you just have to wait. Exciting, isn't it?
Now we have more questions, but can we change the computers? I don't know if we have to change computers. And then question over there.
Have you found any correlation between phenotype and body type?
For a number of reasons, because
you have a mouse, yes.
By body type, I guess you possibly mean the Sheldonian concepts of ectomorph, mesomorph, and so on. I think there is a very interesting relationship between body composition and behavioral expression, which Sheldon spoke about more than 50 years ago, and people have put on in the cupboard since then. But so I don't have an answer to the question, but I think it's an interesting question.